like to begin by thanking Pierre and Ken for asking me to talk to you today, and also thanking you for coming. And one more thank you to the folks that have worked with me on this project, Tom Wynn for many years, Chris Felt, the recent graduate student, Neil Cobb, as we've already heard in the first two talks, insects and fungi can interact in a number of ways. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is not an interaction that is direct like the ones we've heard about, but rather one that is likely indirect. And then I'm going to talk to you about, So the fungi that I'm going to talk about occur below ground in association with the roots of the plant, and they might be affected by plants that feed on, by herbivores that feed on plant tissues, for example, indirectly, or in contrast, they might change characteristics of the plant that in turn influence insects either above or potentially below ground. Why these fungi? Mycorrhizal fungi are a well-known and widespread symbiosis where the plants benefit by receiving improved access to nutrients and water from the fungus, and the fungus receives most or all of their energy from the plant, so they can be all of the biosynthesis. And this is a little picture of how the root morphology and ectomycorrhizal change in the plant, and almost anybody who studies mycorrhizal big plant, little plant picture, and I love really slow growing stuff, so this is mine. So here's a plant that's 4 months old and it's inoculated with mycorrhizal fungi, and then here's its same seed source neighbor that doesn't have fungus. You can see that they can have big impact on this plant. And the mechanism for this, you can see in this famous picture now from David Reed, where you have a pine seedling here, and this is the roots of the pine seedling. Right here, they're all colonized by mycorrhizal fungi, which then hyphae the fungus and explores much more of the soil than the roots dug along. And you can also see these little humans coming up here too, and you can see the plants being interconnected in this big below ground network. And if you actually take the trouble to measure it, there's about 200 feet of hyphae in. So my goals today are twofold. One is to briefly just tell you a little bit about the kinds of studies that have been done and what they found, looking at how mycorrhizal fungi and insects interact, and then also describe some work that we're doing that really makes, I think, it important to take a community perspective and not look at presence or absence, but rather to look at the community and the involvement. I'm going to start by looking at how mycorrhizal fungi might influence insects. This is sort of a summary of what you can see in the literature, and there's really only probably about 30 sort of examples of interactions between fungi and insects through this means, and what you can see is lots of variability that goes all in one direction. So you can see that the two different kinds, major kinds of mycorrhizal fungi, can influence herbivores, and sometimes about half the time they can have a positive influence, about a third of the time they have a negative influence, and sometimes they have no influence at all. There's also a few studies which show that mycorrhizal fungi can influence the enemies of herbivores. So you see a really separated interaction between these organisms. There's also some recent studies which show that mycorrhizal fungi can influence pollinators, not only through the obvious big condition when you have microraptor fungi and when you don't. Okay, compare that to you. And that's going to be important. Okay, if you look at the reverse, what we see with herbivores, for example, and how they impact mycorrhizal fungi indirectly, again, there's only, for insects, there's only about 10 studies, and there's a nice spread of plus positive effects, negative effects, and a few no effects. So it's all over the map. The mechanism is thought to be these negative effects is carbon limitation, and again, there seems to always be a negative relationship between those herbivores and mycorrhizal fungi. And here again, the studies have tended to focus on the abundance of the mycorrhizae. So how do insects influence the abundance of mycorrhizal fungi? But what recent research in mycorrhizal fungi has shown from sort of other perspectives is that both the diversity and the species composition of these fungi are really important to look at. They're not all functionally redundant. They can't all be put in one group together. In fact, the extramycorrhizal fungi that I'll focus on for the rest of this talk, there's about 6,000 species known to form this kind of symbiosis. So they're very diverse. They bring in different kinds of nutrients. They provide different kinds of environmental conditions. And so that sort of context dependency that Ken was talking about is what we really important in the system. And so what I'm going to do now is just to a couple of examples from the system in which I've been working for many years now and show you the importance of potentially of community structures. And first I want to take sort of the simpler case, and we thought it was all going to work this way, and it turned out not to. so we have a pig and pig scale here, which feeds on young pinyon trees, and occurs now throughout the southwestern United States, but it's in northern Arizona, and that's where this research is focused. It's a mesophyll feeder, and it tends to occur on some trees in really high densities, and not to occur even at all on a tree right next to it. Okay, so here we have what we've been calling a resistant tree, and here we have a susceptible tree, where high levels of these scale effects have over a billion scales in a tree this fall lead to premature needle estrogen and basically a tree that has a little tuft of green needles and everything else is falling off. They're pretty dramatic. And so we look to see that not only do we see changes in the abundance of mycorrhizal fungi between these two kinds of trees, but also what happens to the community of those fungi, given that we have potentially a very diverse community to choose from. And so we've done this by collecting roots and looking at those individual mycorrhizal roots and using molecular approaches to characterize the community. And what I'm going to show you here is just an ordination of the fungal community. So each of these dots represents the fungal community of an individual tree, and the closer that these symbols are to one another, the closer their communities are to one another. And what you can see here is that you get pretty nice separation between trees that have lots of scales and those that do not. So you get pretty good differences in the community. If we actually look at by sequencing and whatnot who those fungi are, we see that on the trees with lots of scale effects, we end up having a community that's dominated by a particular group of ascomycin fungi. That's what these sort of red and brown colors here are. And we see some of those fungi on low scale trees, but we have a predominance of this entire different group of fungi that occur on the low scale trees. And so we see things that are, and we know that there's a functional variation between these two. So we see a big change in the fungal community as well as in the fungal abundance. And we can actually compress that sort of community variation into a single number. We have a little bit of data reduction there, just an index of mycorrhizal fungal community composition here. And you can actually relate it to how much damage is caused by the scale effect. And you get a pretty nice linear relationship of community change with the disease, which suggests that in this situation, we have the insect driving changes in the fungal community. nice evidence that there's a genetic basis to resistance and susceptibility. So you again see resistant and susceptible trees on the landscape, but in this case, you can actually have evidence of that genetic basis, and that becomes important. And if we look at these trees, we can see chronic erosion through time leads to susceptible trees having a very altered architecture, so they're easy to pick out on the landscape. And you can see that both above ground, and we've done some new exposure studies to see what it looks like below ground as well. So you have susceptible architecture, resistant architecture. And just to give you an idea of how this tracks through time, so Tom picked the study with Tom Whittem in the early 80s, and we've been tracking them ever since. This data goes to 2002, and you can see that the susceptible trees have a larger number of moss that stems than the resistant trees through time, and the only exceptions to that that we see are during really extreme drought years where basically the trees don't produce any shoots and there aren't any moss, so they don't actually grow for the moss on the present angle. Tom also had the wisdom to set up in 1983 a removal experiment, in which he took a group of trees like this, and using a one-time-a-year systemic insecticide, he removed the moss, and he's been doing it with my help and a couple of others ever since. And now we have a group of trees that, when you look at them on the landscape, they start to look a lot more like resistant trees. So we have an experiment, and we can actually try to look then at how the relationship between insect herbivory and lots of features of the trees works, and also how the mycorrhizal relationship works. And see, that's what he's done. And what I initially hypothesized going into this, and partly based on what we've seen with the scale, and partly based on what we've seen with this abundance of mycorrhizae, I thought the insects would be driving changes in mycorrhizal community composition. And so I expected if I compared resistant and susceptible trees, I would get different mycorrhizal communities, but then removal trees over time would come to look like the resistant trees, just like they do in their own. And so 10 years after Tom set up the removal experiment, I went out and sampled this using molecular tools. And here, for reasons that will become obvious later, instead of showing each individual point, I'm just showing you sort of an average community with an index of variation around the side, because eventually I'll have lots of points to show you. And so here, what we ended up seeing 10 years after moss removal is not what I thought at all. Instead, the resistant trees stay separate from the susceptible trees and the moss removal trees. So even though the trees look the same, the communities of fungi remain different. Well, who knows what's going on? I went to Australia, I came back, started working with student Chris Stoltz, and we did it again in 2004. And we thought, well, maybe this takes a while. And what we saw in 2004, so now I have 1994 data and 2004 data, was that the resistant trees still grouped together, and they group away from the susceptible and removal trees. And so this suggests either the communities are very resistant to change with the environmental change and the change in their condition of their host, or that there's a genetic component to this. And so we have these basically two hypotheses that we were trying to compare against one another here. And in order to look at this, we went into the greenhouse to do an experiment. I'll describe that experiment now. In which we vary seed source to get at the genetic influence and soil source to get at the environmental influence. And so basically what we did, we took seeds from resistant mothers, susceptible mothers, and from removal tree mothers, and we grew them in resistant soil from resistant trees to get resistant inoculants or resistant communities. And then we also did that with susceptible inoculants and removal tree inoculants. And we replicated it 9 times in a reciprocal way. And what we found was, this is a little while to digest, but just remember that if seed source is most important, then the symbol, the separation will be by color. And if soil source is more important, the separation of the points will be by shape. Okay? And nothing, if it's all a big mess, then there's no way to it. But what we see is that the communities on the surface graph here is group by color and not by shape. Okay, so what matters is your seed source, not your soil source. Okay, this is a big surprise to us, and it suggests that you have a strong genetic component to mycorrhizal community. And that in the sort of simple case of scale, now we have maybe no interaction at all between mycorrhizae and insects on those resistant susceptible trees in the moss. Instead, maybe there's just parallel things going on with resistance and susceptibility at a particular community. And so we also, with that, to try to get a handle on this and understand it more, look at the performance of those seedlings. So how well do those seedlings grow in a greenhouse? And so here's the same experiment. And what we found was that we looked at seedlings from resistant mothers compared to those from susceptible removal mothers, that the seedlings were smaller from the resistant mothers. Okay? And that was interesting, and we thought, well, that's not what we would have thought either. And then we looked at our group of plants that had no mycorrhizal fungi, and that difference was huge. And so this suggests that having this particular community of mycorrhizal fungi leads to differences in resistant and susceptible trees in growth. And what we think might be happening now is that maybe this is a whole different way of interacting. And partly that's because the data that John Sewell published in 2003, which when you look at resistant and susceptible trees using ringwood sediment for time, and remember they don't get attacked by moths until they're mature, they kind of get attacked in later years. What you see is that in the field, just like we saw in the greenhouse experiment, the susceptible trees grow bigger. Okay, so if they have that mycorrhizal community and they grow bigger, then maybe the interaction is actually reversed. And instead, what might be going on is that you have a genetic basis for forming a particular community of mycorrhizal fungi, which makes you grow bigger, and it actually turns out to make you be more drought tolerant as well. And that influences selection or performance, a preference for performance by the moth. So it may actually be flipped on its head. And of course, this would require an experiment to test this. And the experiment that it requires is inoculating and not inoculating and with the resistant and susceptible communities, and then adding the moth on there. And unfortunately, since the moth doesn't like the trees until they're about 25 or 30, I need to get help from the younger members of the audience to, you know, have me do this experiment for the next 25 years. Anyway, so it's a little bit of a dead end there, unfortunately. I want to come back now and just summarize really quickly and sort of make 3 points in conclusion. One is that at least most of the evidence from the studies that we've done and the studies in the literature suggest that these indirect interactions between mycorrhizae and fungi and insects are potentially important. They mostly influence each other's performance. And there's very few studies that try to look at it in a more holistic perspective, but they're suggesting that those interactions are important. Mechanistically, we have a really poor understanding of what's happening. So we have some hypotheses about plant-intensive chemistry, when we go in one direction, about carbon limitation, when we go in another direction. But it's very, very rudimentary. And I hope I've convinced you with the studies that I just talked about in a little more detail that the community perspective is important, that not all of those mycorrhizal fungi